Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Stage A Place with me, your host Elliot Shepherd. We're going to cut straight into this week's episode as we've got a lot to talk about with this week's guest, as I was joined by Spike Hart a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to chat a little bit about his journey into directing as well as his acting and his technical work. So we're going to cut straight in and I hope you enjoy the show. As a recent graduate from Mount View Academy of Theatre Arts, today's guest is a jack of all trades. From acting to directing to musical and technical, we are delighted to have Spike Hart in the studio with us today. Spike, welcome to The Stagey Place.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming along, Spike. So tell me, how are you feeling currently in the isolation period? Are you finding yourself creative and productive, or are you taking a backseat and having a rest?
Good question, actually. To be honest, I think I'm just doing as I'm told. Like, it's quite a serious situation, obviously. And I live with an NHS staff member. So the best thing I can do really is to stay indoors. And in terms of keeping productive, I mean, it's kind of tricky when you're sort of penned in, but also I think we're seeing the best kind of qualities of the internet at the moment. And obviously being in that kind of creative circle, there's lots of people hopping online with, I've seen someone, I think it was an actor, read Roald Dahl's The Twits just on a live stream. I think we're seeing a nice quality of social media, I think, at this time. I suppose there's loads of stuff you could do. Learn to paint. It's interestingly, actually, before we went into isolation, I went into the charity shop because I kind of knew it was going to come. It's just a matter of when. And I went and found some puzzles. And there weren't many left. I think there was a big rush of people going to get puzzles, because they knew that they're going to get stuck indoors at some point. So the charity shops have been rinsed of puzzles, but it's okay because I've got a few in the cupboard, so I keep myself entertained.
Yeah, of course. In our family, we do a lot of puzzles around Christmas time. We usually get the annual puzzle from the shop. And it's really lovely, but you know, we've not really done it throughout this lockdown, basically because, you know, most of us are still working from home, but you know, we've managed to find ourselves productive. So let's go back to your childhood then, Spike, if we can. Can you tell me when you first got into theatre? Was this from a young age, or was this, you know, further down the line in school?
Well, to be honest, I don't really remember school that much. It was, for me, it's just kind of, I don't know, like a blur of blue blazes. I wasn't really involved in school productions. I did a GCSE in drama, and the only reason that happened was because I originally had chosen IT, and I found just sort of staring at spreadsheets week after week really boring, so I asked if I could swap, because I had a friend that said that I could use the lights and tinker about with sort of techie stuff in a more kind of practical setting, whereas with the IT it was a bit more, I suppose, theoretical. Yeah, that's how I ended up doing a GCSE in drama. And then from there, it was college, which is obviously where we crossed paths for that first time. And that, again, was a fluke. When I went to that college open day, I mean, I was never meant to do performing arts. Like, I didn't go in there to choose a drama course at all. I went and I was very serious about looking at the vocational stuff. And I just happened to drop by the desk with the arts and media staff, and they persuaded me just to give it a go. I ended up going from drama not being a very integral part of my sort of education to it being full-time 2 years on that diploma.
And would you say that's when you started to take drama seriously?
I was there for 2 years, and I think college and further education is a really good stepping stone between being a school child and actually being a student at university or in higher education. It just gives you that bit more independence. It was an amazing 2 years. It was great fun. And I never felt that the stakes were too high either. Like, I mean, there was that kind of performance pressure, which most of us enjoyed. So yeah, that's where it started, really.
Yeah, and actually it's funny because out of those 2 years that we did, it was only me and you who went off to university straight after college. So was that always kind of like the end game for you after college, or were you like some others wanted to go into work straight away?
Yeah, I think I've always been sort of fairly short-sighted, and that's perhaps one of my weaknesses, because I went into college thinking that I was an individual that wasn't supposed to go to university or into higher education. I didn't think that that was what fate had in store for me. I did, just because I hadn't performed well in exams prior to that point. University wasn't really on the agenda until the second year of that college course, when sort of we started looking at UCAS, and I started to realise that actually I did have, or I'd built up the grades throughout that first year to kind of sneak into a higher education course. And I remember going to university thinking, I'm not sure if I'm actually, I've got the brains to get through this. I specifically remember in that first week asking people, like, has anyone else stressed about how difficult the coursework will be, or about how difficult it is to construct and to write a good essay? So yeah, I never really thought that far ahead about a career or what the jobs would be. I just thought first year of uni, and then if I could get through that year, then that was second year, and if I could get through second year, third year, and so on. So it was always, and I suppose I'm still doing that in a lot of ways, just year by year, working my way through.
And so did you think at that point, after those first few weeks of uni, that that was exactly where you wanted to be in your career? Or did you ever have doubts about whether or not you wanted to continue uni?
No, I didn't get myself into too deep a water until probably second year. And it was never to do with the academic stuff. I quickly learned at uni that I was actually very capable of completing that course. And I feel like most people were. It wasn't actually that difficult. It wasn't until second year when I started doing extracurricular stuff to kind of build up experience and things that I sort of really put pressure on myself. There was a time when I was in a play that was being done by third years, that was Punk Rock, and I was William, and obviously he's kind of the central character to that and has a huge amount of lines. At the same time, I was doing Citizenship with You and another company, and also West Side Story at the Theatre Royal, and I was only an ensemble member in that, but it's a dance show, so there's quite a lot of choreography to learn. So that was four projects going on at once on top of what was actually happening within my degree. And that was kind of probably around March, April. And I remember feeling a bit pressured by that whole experience, as well as sort of personal relationships at that time were quite challenging. So yeah, that was probably the time where I was like, this is a lot. But I think in some ways the sort of successes with that kind of made it worth it. I remember finishing that run of Punk Rock, and when the lights went down on the last scene, that feeling was, I've not felt anything like that since that happened, having successfully done a run as a lead in a full-length play. That was amazing. And then with West Side Story as well, the final show in the Theatre Royal, which is a gorgeous regional theatre, that Saturday happened to fall on my 21st birthday. Doing a musical and having Happy Birthday 72 on a stage like that was really special. So there's special moments intertwined with all the graft that just sort of you can't get anywhere else.
So having already celebrated your 21st birthday then at the Theatre Royal in Bath, would you say that was kind of the pinnacle of your university career? Or would you say there was something else that kind of springs to mind that, you know, you enjoyed?
I'd say that came in third year. Or actually towards, so by the end of those projects, that's when I applied to direct the third year musical. And I'd seen, when I'd applied to the course years before, in the third year there was a big musical and they chose a student to direct it. And I always thought, wouldn't that be amazing to be the person to direct it? And I remember them sending out the application form, and I applied and went to speak to a few of the tutors that, yeah, they had me on board. And I started almost working on third year projects at the end of my second year, and doing prep before that summer, and kind of figuring out what I needed to do over that summer break to come back into a rehearsal room in that September of my third year, that start. So that was really exciting. And then that whole process was amazing. It was really difficult, but that was probably my highlight, that directing that show.
And how do you think that university prepared you then for leaving? Because, you know, you didn't go straight into another degree, for example.
So the thing with uni is there's a lot of them. They produce a lot of graduates in drama, which makes finding work really, really hard. But I was quite lucky and got employed back at the college as a technician. And I never really envisioned sort of doing technical work, but it just so happened that through the years I'd just been to the local theatre and got stuck in. So I had over the years built up quite a bit of experience in that sort of technical side of things, which came in handy when it getting a job. So I had a weird all-round experience in lots of different things, which made getting a job maybe for me a bit more not easy. But I'd been very cautious to give myself a wider breadth as possible, so that when it came to getting a job, I was able to do that. I remember going to see a show when I was quite young, and it had loads of actor musos in, and I kept going to the theatre and seeing more and more actor musos and how popular they were. So I thought, actually, I need to get onto that. So that's why I picked up instruments, just because I was like, I need to be able to do that if it's needed. The same with technical stuff. I need to be able to rig lights and program a desk if that's needed. I need to be able to step up and lead a rehearsal room if that's needed in a directorial sense, and I need to be able to act if that's needed. So I just tried to get stuck in everywhere, which kind of led me into that directing world as well, because that the director's sort of, I suppose the role is to have a finger in all pies and just to know what's going on so it's possible to tie that stuff together.
So let's get ahead then. You've had your year at college doing the technician role. At which point then did you decide that you wanted to go into drama school in Mountview?
Well, it was not easy to get through the door. I applied actually to go straight from undergrad and was kept on the reserve list sort of months on end. I think I applied in October and then waited until the following summer to finally get rejected, and then to then apply the next autumn and then to wait to the next summer to then get a phone call to say I've been offered a place. I mean, it was an amazing feeling to get that offer, because it'd been sort of 2 years of work trying to get there. That second time, I didn't feel like I was going to get any further. The first time when I interviewed, I really made sure to present the best version of myself I could. I wore a smart shirt, a smart jacket, nice shoes, had a haircut, trimmed a beard, and that didn't work. I didn't get in. And then the second year, I travelled to London the night before the interview. I stayed with a friend who was actually at Mountview at the time. I slept on an airbed on his floor, and then I sort of rolled up kind of with an overgrown beard, wearing a scruffy sweater and jeans, looking a bit dishevelled and not really feeling that great. And then doing an interview which I didn't really think was that good an interview, kind of coming away having a more, in some ways, a more negative response to my first interview. I mean, I got reserve listed again, and I think that's what happens to most candidates. But yeah, and ended up getting a phone call 8 or 9 months later, and I was just waiting for an email that just said, sorry, not this time. And then I got a phone call, and that was it. Was in.
And if you hadn't have got in that second year, then do you think you would have applied again, or would you have, you know, put that aside and gone through a different route? Because I know, you know, rejection is quite hard on some people.
I think I had maybe one more year left in me. I think I would have probably gone one more, third time lucky, and that would have taken me to, you know, 24, the age I am now. And so yeah, I don't know, I think maybe one more year. But then I would be training now, and it would all have been interrupted by this outbreak. So fate has weird ways of working. And I extend my thoughts to people who are in training at the moment, who've had, you know, showcases and things cancelled. That must be heartbreaking when it's so hard to get to that position, especially anyone in postgrad courses that are a year long who've lost half their training essentially, or have had half of that training compromised, and third years who have trained for 2 years for shows and showcases that have been cancelled. I mean, obviously that's the right thing to do for safety, but it's still sad.
Yeah, of course. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of initiatives out at the moment for third year graduates to send in self-tapes and, you know, show reels to put on for, you know, virtual showcases for them. At Mountview then, what was your kind of highlight working with the actors and a lot of practitioners as well?
So, yeah, I suppose the whole course itself was great. I probably enjoyed the first sort of 6 months the most. So getting there in September, doing skills up until Christmas, and then assisting Alex Thorpe, who's done a few bits for the RSC. And we were working on As You Like It. As an assistant, I didn't do much in terms of contribute to the project, but just to be in a room and watch a director actually put a show together in a in a drama school context was really fascinating. And he had a very unique way of working, and I've kind of coined a lot of that. I've taken a lot of what I use now as my practice, what came from that first assistantship. And I tried a lot of those ideas in just after Christmas in a play called Bull, which is a Mike Bartlett play. Brilliant, brilliant play. I love it, absolutely love it. And I hadn't heard of it before being assigned it on that project. It's working with a few postgrad actors. Were great fun to work with. I mean, being in training, they were young and, you know, really keen to give everything their best go. And that was just brilliant to facilitate for. And a lot of those ideas were great. I hate using this phrase, but sort of a playground for the actors. Rather than me say, okay, do it like this or do it like this, I'd go in 10 minutes before we were due to start rehearsing with a bag of random props, which included things like a shoe, a notepad, pens, playing cards, newspaper, ribbon, just random stuff that I had lying around at home. And I asked the actors to do the same, just to come in with 10 random props. And then at the start of the rehearsal, we'd throw the props on the floor and scatter them around, and then divvy the play into chunks. And I just said, let's play in the space and use the objects as props. It doesn't have to be what it actually is. It's fascinating watching actors pick up a playing card when they're trying to emphasize a point and using that card and pointing it at whoever it is they're addressing. And other things that happen, like there was a scarf, and at one point one of the characters or one of the actors just decided that on that line they'd pick up and fold that scarf. And lots of these things that happen that are coming from them, as opposed to me saying, okay, at this point I want you to move that chess piece, or at this point I want you to sit on the sofa. It comes from them, which is my favourite way of working. Is obviously, as a director, I want to provide an insurance policy, like an insurance idea for blocking, but what I prefer is to give every imagination within the room space to contribute, and then to work as in more of an editorial sense on that, or what gets given to me. And I know for a fact those actors had a great time. And this is something that I need to emphasise, really, is that as actors and as directors and as people in theatre, I think one thing we need to always make sure we're doing is having fun, because that's why we do it. We need to make sure we enjoy these processes, because if we don't, then we might as well be doing a job, like an office job or something, that we're not going to enjoy, but living on a secure wage, knowing where the work's coming from, because we sacrifice potential earnings by doing what we do, and we do that because we know we love it. And if we let that go, then I see that as quite a big problem. And that's probably why people who drop out of doing theatre drop out, because they stop enjoying themselves, and that's integral, because otherwise why else are we doing it?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I could have really put it better. Like you say, you know, it's that perseverance, I think, because, you know, this industry, it's not the most well paid, and, you know, it's not always the most reliable, but we get up every morning and we do the same job that we do because we absolutely love it. And like you say, you know, we love playing in the rehearsal room, you know, it's great. So obviously that was Bull by Mark Bartlett, which you just referenced with your rehearsal space. I want to move on to another play that you did at the end of the year, which was World's End by Paul Seller, and produced by Lacey Rutley, who we all, us three, all crossed paths doing Citizenship a couple of years ago at the Bristol Old Vic. Tell me a little bit about World's End and how you came about it, because I remember at the time it was one that you were really passionate about.
I mean, I came across it just sort of scanning the library, and a few things within the play itself resonated with me. I mean, the play is set in London. It's about a couple who've just broken up, and she's coming around to essentially gather up her stuff because she's moved out. And then her new partner ends up showing up kind of a third of the way into the play to help her move her stuff to their new place while he's still in the old place. And then her friend joins in as well. And the text had lots of nice nods to, I suppose, rural areas such as the Cotswolds and Devon, and it spoke to people who would have maybe travelled to London to pursue a creative outlet or a professional outlet.
Yeah, of course, and I'm sure a lot of people would like to know what it's like auditioning so many people for, you know, what was it, 3-4 roles. What's that like from the other side of the table?
It's equally nerve-wracking, actually, because there's not just stakes for auditionees, but also for you as a director casting what at that time was our big sort of project. So, yeah, it was nerve-wracking. There were definitely quite high stakes. And it was tiring as well. We saw, over 2 days, we saw maybe 200 actors. So we saw a lot of people. The panel was myself and another director on my course. So we were both casting our own shows. So they'd audition for my show and then they'd audition for him. And then we wouldn't really have a chance to chat about it. I mean, we probably just put a tick on our list or a line or whatever it was, depending on who it was. And it was aggressively competitive. My play was a four-hander. The pay wasn't the best. It was fair pay. And it was tricky to... I cast one actor who is actually from Cheltenham. I didn't ask anyone where they were from, apart from this person. And she came in, she did a really brilliant monologue. Just in the conversation, I asked where she was from, and it turned out we were from the same hometown. It was just so brilliant. And then a guy came in, his name was Tom, and he was terrific as well. And I really thought I could cast him in the lead. And I did go on to recall him and cast him, but he went... got a job offer for another project. I mean, that happened quite close to the start of rehearsals. And then a couple of the other actors, or the last two, one of them actually worked in Mountview, graduated from their acting programme a couple of years before. And another one was a graduate from the acting programme at my university. So I had this cast of someone from my hometown, someone from the drama school I was at, and someone who'd been to the university, which was really nice to see sort of those different parts of my life all in one room.
Quite a small world then, really.
Yeah, it's incredibly small. I had a few people come from my old uni, and I didn't cast them because of that. I obviously cast them because they were the best fits for the role. And then the guy I ended up casting in the lead, as I said, the first guy dropped out, and I had to find someone really quickly. And like, I had less than a week to do it. Four rehearsals were meant to start. I ended up calling on Joe, who's I've known for years. I went to uni with him. And this was the guy that I actually stayed with the night before my interview. Yeah, he came and he fits in terms of the picture I'd made with three characters I already cast. He fitted into that. And then the process for that, I mean, for me, that was probably one of the worst processes I've had. Things went wrong that were just sort of outside of my control. The show obviously being about her coming in to move her stuff out, it made it a prop heavy show because there was stuff that needed to be put in boxes at times during the show. And kind of halfway through the process, which was like 4 or 5 weeks, this process, really short, all of my props went missing. The chest that I used, the cover boxes, and I couldn't find them for almost a week and a half, 2 weeks, which sort of stalled the final blocking and the tightening of those screws. And then the week before the show was actually due to be on, the guy who played the lead, Joe, his mum had a heart attack and almost passed away. Joe got the phone call about all of that unfolding in Newton Abbott down in Devon as we were rehearsing. So suddenly a good friend of mine has sort of left the room, come back in tears. There's me with three other actors. Okay, how do I sort of, what do I do? And I just said, you know, let's just stop here. I don't think we can focus on making work in this situation. And then Joe heads off to Devon, so I don't see him for a week. So then I've got to find another actor with about 6 days until the show. I had a couple of conversations with a few actors that I'd been put in touch with, but they quickly fell through when those actors realised the enormity of the task, the amount of lines they'd have to learn and the blocking and everything. And at that point, I really thought that it was over. Luckily, the three actors I was working with just carried on, and it got to the point where I started learning the lines myself because I knew the play, I knew the blocking, I was the right age. It was a difficult thing to do because I'm not a trained actor, and I didn't want it to look like I was just trying to be a hero and save the project by sort of stepping into the lead, you know, that cliche. But I literally ran out of options. I didn't know what to do. And one of the other directors offered to do it as well. And I would have said yes, but he was, you know, having a bit of a tricky time with his show at that time as well. So we were all under immense pressure. So I ended up starting to learn this play, and it's a 60-page text, and he's in all of it apart from maybe 2 or 3 pages, this character. I learned sort of the first 40 pages, and about 2 or 3 days before the show was back on, Joe gave me a ring and said, look, my mum's recovered, I think I should come back and do it. And my mum was saying the same thing, like, it'd be a shame for this work to go to waste. I was like, I agreed, and I was like, of course. So he came back and we had a couple of days of intense rehearsal to try and pull things back together, and then it just sort of happened over the next few days. And I remember on the day of the tech, losing my voice, because I'd been so intensely sort of learning lines and speaking that by the actual tech, I didn't have a voice left. After doing a dress run, a few of the actors were like, "Are you crying? Your voice is breaking up." And I was like, "No, I think I'm just actually quite ill." And so yeah, it was that was a tough process. But the writer came and he really enjoyed the show, and I got good feedback, and it was maybe 60 or 70% of what it could have been. But I think given the circumstances, it was a very good learning experience, I'll give it that. And I think in terms of the ideas and the show and the using that kind of text and working in a round as well as a configuration, I think the process works. The circumstances then were just sort of stacked slightly against me. So yeah, that was tricky, but Mount View as an experience was, I mean, there are bits of it that I loved and there are bits of it that I despised. And that was just it really.
So now that you've left Mountain View then, how would you say you define yourself as an individual now you have a degree in directing from a drama school?
I feel as though I'm quite good at facilitating and I'm quite a good teacher. And that's since Mountain View. I mean, it's left there in September. Well, that's when I submitted my dissertation. And since then, I've been teaching in further education, ironically, in that same college where I worked as a technician and where we met and went. So it was really weird teaching courses that I was once a student on in the classrooms that I was once a student in. But what's useful about teaching from a directorial standpoint is that you are planning lessons in the same way that you might plan a rehearsal. You are facilitating students in the same way you might facilitate actors. So you keep those skills going. You don't drop that ball. You keep exercising those muscles. So I find from a directorial standpoint, teaching is a really good option if you can get into it. I've been quite lucky to sort of swooped in there without a PGCE, and I feel as though the training from Mount View and 3 years of undergrad has more than done what it needs to do in order to equip me to do that and to carry out lesson plans and all of the kind of hoops you have to jump through within education. But, and there are a lot of those. So yeah, I think the thing with teaching as well is when you're starting off, it pays ends meet. And that's something that you've got to start doing at some point. I know a lot of actors and directors are great creators in their own right. And I don't call myself a professional director. I call myself someone that's trained as a director. So, and I'm not really a director because at the moment I'm not directing any work. And I know people that are doing stuff, a lot of people doing pub theatre and sort of fringe gigs here and there. I appreciate what they're doing, but in my head I know that the chances are they're probably making a loss, or that someone within that project is making a loss. Whether it's the time spent, the venue hire, whatever it is. I was in a show sort of last autumn, or just before Christmas even. I was working as an actor musician, which was great fun. I'd always wanted to do that. It was a bit weird because I'd not been in a show for a long time, having focused on sort of directing stuff. But it was amazing fun. But at the end of it, I got paid about £40. And I was commuting to London about 2 or 3 times a week for about a month and a half. And I knew when I was getting into that project that it was going to cost me financially, but I wanted the experience, so I did it anyway. And it was an important project to me.
Yeah, and I also think that's kind of a balancing act, isn't it? Because we're both fairly recent out of drama school. And we're trying to get the money and the experience, but also use that degree at the same time.
Yeah, at the moment we certainly do. And I think the thing with that as well is it cost me hundreds of pounds in travel to do that show, and I got £30-40 back. The experience of doing it was worth it for me in that instance. But what I think the point I'm getting at is that for me that makes theatre a hobby, because it's something I do for fun that's not helping me put food on the table or pay rent, whereas teaching is doing that for me. And I think that's what we need to be careful of doing, is falling into the habit of doing so much fringe theatre but not actually choosing work that's going to help us. If it's not making you money, it's essentially a hobby. And the other thing that I find as well with those shows, I can't even really going on the record as saying this, but I do think it's an important point, is that I go to a lot of fringe shows and see an audience who are relatives or friends of the person that's made the show, not just theatregoers. And I don't know, I just feel as though you should aspire to make work that is relevant enough to draw people to the work as opposed to the individual making the work. So as a friend going to see a show, I'd go and see and support a friend of mine that's made a show. But what I'm really interested in is that show appealing to me as well? Because I want to go and see I mean, I should be going. You should be going to see the work as opposed to see the individual creating the work for support. Although you can do both, obviously. It's an interesting thing. In order to make that fringe theatre or pub theatre a career as opposed to a hobby, then you need to be able to draw audiences beyond your friendship and family. And not to, to hate on anyone that's put hours into making and hundreds of pounds into making a fringe show. I don't want to hate on you, and I appreciate the fact that you go to the effort to make that work. But at some point, you've got to step back and go, is this going to work in the long term? Is this going to actually be a career, or is this just a hobby?
So Spike, what advice would you give to listeners who are listening to this episode and want to know which direction they should take within the industry?
One piece of advice. It's a tricky one because I feel like as a teacher, my job has been to give lots of advice to lots of 16, 17-year-old want-to-be actors. I'd say it depends where you are. So if you're 16, 17 doing A-levels and you're just sort of starting out, my advice to you would be a yes man. Just say yes to the opportunities. That's what I did when I was that age. I just said yes. It doesn't matter what it was. Front of house, yes. Switch this light on and off, yes. Rip those tickets, yes. Fire watch, yes. Be in this show, yes. Direct this play, yes. Just say yes, because then you build up the experiences. As you get further on, that's when you need to be more diligent and decide what projects you want to invest your time in, because your time, as you get more experience, becomes more valuable. And I think I learned that in second year of uni when I said that I'd taken on all of those shows at once, those projects. I kind of reflected on that and thought, I wish that I'd been more selective and chose the ones that were the most beneficial to me as an individual. Be a yes man, and then by doing that, you'll learn when you need to stop saying yes to everything. And by that point, you will have hopefully managed to focus on one particular sort of route in terms of the profession, whether that's sort of technical stuff or acting or directing or being a musician or whatever it is. But it's, I think, yeah, to have a breadth of skills that you can bring to any project is really useful. So again, long-winded answer, but get a breadth of knowledge. And then after a few years, be careful about how you implement that and use it to get the most valuable experience and work you can.
So Spike, obviously, would usually be in a venue of your choice recording this episode right now. And that venue would be your stage place. So can you tell listeners listening to this podcast at the moment where your stagey place is?
My stagey place. This is so difficult. Because we should be there, but because of this COVID-19, we're not. I would probably say the Everyman Theatre in Cheltenham. And I know you've worked there for years. And I suppose the reason for that is when I was doing theatre as a sort of 17, 18-year-old in the Southwest, that was like the mecca, that was the place where I wanted to go and perform. And I felt like I had to kind of work my way up to it. So I had to start in college and impress the tutors enough to put me in contact with people at the Playhouse, which is the community theatre in Cheltenham, to do some things there. And I felt like by doing some things there, I was in a play there and I did some front of house there and some other bits and pieces behind the scenes technical stuff on a few projects. So I felt like that was the stepping stone. So it was college, then doing some stuff in the Playhouse, and then hopefully get a chance to be in a show at the Everyman. And it just so happened that a director came into college who was the artistic director of the Everyman. He did an auditions workshop and he got in touch with me after about a show that he was working on, and he asked me to come and read a bit of a play and do some choreography, and he cast me in this show at the Everyman. And this was just the summer before I was about to go off and go to uni, so it felt like a really nice way to end a sort of chapter of theatre in Cheltenham and Gloucestershire, was to reach that goal working with professional actors who'd all trained at drama school. They had an amazing silver band. It was amazing seeing the silver band, because I used to, when I was a really small guy, I played in that silver band. I played the trombone in that same silver band that he'd got in for that show. I was so young when I was in that silver band that I couldn't reach the end of the slide. My arm wasn't long enough, so the D was always a bit sharp because I couldn't quite get down there. And then the choir as well. So there was an amazing choir, amazing band. So that was really amazing. And also Matcham Theatres are just stunning. If it weren't the Everyman, it would be another Matcham, maybe Buxton Spires Opera House. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but if you go there, it's unbelievably beautiful. It's got this amazing kind of botanical garden sort of wrapped around the side, and the architecture is just stunning. And it's good that those buildings still survive despite, you know, a war. I mean, not all of them have, but a few have, and they're listed now, so that's great.
Ah, oh, perfect. Thanks so much, Spike. What a great choice. Thanks so much for coming on to the Stage Place this week. It's been a real pleasure, and I've really learnt quite a lot. And I cannot wait for the lockdown to be over so we can get back to normal and go to the pub and see a few more shows together. But for now, Spike, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome, absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
And there we go, that was another episode of The Stagey Place with this week's special guest, Spike Art. If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, you can leave us a review on Podbean, Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. Until next time, with our special guest, Sarah Wells, I hope you have a lovely week and I look forward to hearing from you soon.